Moncrief on News Talk.
Right now around the country, families are closely watching news reports from southern Lebanon. Some of them are Lebanese, of course, and some are the families of Irish troops currently serving there as part of UNIFIL. For over four decades, Irish men and women have put themselves in harm's way as part of the United Nations peacekeeping force there. And it can take a toll, both on the families and the soldiers themselves. This is something Chris Donovan's very familiar with. Chris served eight terms in South Lebanon and is now a resident of ONE, the Organisation of National Ex-Service Personnel. Chris, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Sean.
You'd be well used to this kind of thing, of having IDF forces cheat by jowl with you in these kind of situations. I imagine it's very tense.
Yeah, well, you know, we don't hug each other.
Yeah.
You get that close. It's... Tension is probably an understatement, you know, because you're mostly concerned with really not getting killed.
Yeah, I would think. And in your experience, when you're there, the IDF wish you weren't there.
Yeah, well, you were the meat and the sandwich, you know. You have to be fair to every side. You're there to help the people that are there. You're not there to help the combatants on either side. So what they do strictly isn't your business, except when it impacts on you.
Yeah.
And when it impacts, it can really hurt.
Yeah. And in what ways can it impact?
Well, they have this new term now, kinetic activity. It's really just, it's a nice word for being shelled or being shot at or being bombed. And that happens a lot. Irish soldiers over the years have kind of, like every army learns from its experience, it learns lessons very, very quickly and it adapts. The Irish Army in Lebanon adapted very, very quickly to these things. Really good bunker protection, bulletproof glass on the OPs. But there are times where you have to step out into the fire and make decisions. And that's what peacekeeping is. Peacekeeping is low-intensity warfare. We're not equipped for modern war fighting. We're well equipped for peacekeeping. But in order to keep the peace, you have to be respected by both sides, because when you stand in, you're neutral. And you try and help the people that are there. And one or other side can prevent you, or both sides can prevent you doing that.
Yeah. And would they try to prevent you doing that?
Every time. Every time. These people have no mercy. You know, they have a war-fighting objective, and collateral damage is collateral damage.
You know,
so if they kill a few peacekeepers, as they've done, if they massacre a few hundred civilians, as they've done, it's just collateral damage.
Yeah. And from the point of view of the Irish Army, has it always been collateral damage, or have there been instances where you felt it was deliberate?
Well, it's documented. Look at Dermot McLaughlin.
Yeah.
He was I think he was a Galway man. They fired a flechette from a tank. The flechette's got hundreds of little darts in it, and it's designed as an anti-personnel round specifically. And they fired it into his billet in Brashit. I think it was about 1989 or 1990.
Yeah.
And Dermot McLaughlin was killed outright. And that was murder because they fired directly into UN position.
Yeah.
They stoke the fire, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And see what comes out of it.
Yeah. And so so when you were serving there, for most people who are serving there, people have different areas of responsibility, of course, but what's a normal day?
It's hard to explain. If you're a carpenter, you go to work and you make stools, tables, whatever you do.
Mm.
You know, if you're a plumber, you do whatever. If you do your, this is your normal day. But your normal day over there, you're living an elevated nervous state, because you're constantly expecting the unexpected. You're constantly planning for where will you go. If you're walking, where will it go? Fire erupts, will it go to the left? Will it go to the right? You're assessing the route you're taking. You know, everything is thought out and planned. And you've actions on what happens if this happens, what happens if that happens. And you have your state of being is constantly elevated. That's your normal day. You expect to get shelled, you expect to get fired at, you expect to return fire, you expect to be in a difficult position. That's your normal day.
God, that's not much of a God. And say then, like, if you're out on a patrol and you're that kind of, you have that heightened sense, when, you know, you're back indoors in Camp Shamrock, can you calm down then?
Well, Camp Shamrock's a HQ. Mm. You know, it's kind of in the rear with the gear.
Yeah.
You go out with the companies, and you're behind the lines, you're patrolling. It's quite a difficult environment, you know.
Mm.
can't really say very much about it because I don't want to be causing people worry.
No, of course not.
You know,
no.
Given the current situation, it's unfair. Like the army have a well-paid press officer, and he does a great job. He or she does a great job. So on matters operational, I would defer to them always.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you were 19 when you first went out there.
Yeah, I was. Yeah.
God, that's a hell of a shock for a 19-year-old.
I volunteered.
Yeah.
I couldn't wait.
Mm.
As soon as I got out there, we landed in Tel Aviv in Israel, and very, very modern city. You're driving up through, in the back of a truck going up through Israel, and you go, this doesn't look bad, this looks good, you know. And you get closer to the border and you see lines of tanks and you go, well, when you cross the border, you're going back into the Stone Age, because nothing, and I mean nothing, hasn't got a shell hole or a bullet hole in it. And the road goes from a smooth road to a tank testing ground.
Mm.
And it's just a complete culture shock.
Yeah.
But you're a kid. You go, wow. And then you get a little bit apprehensive. And the further you go up into the military, into the zone where you're operating the area of responsibility, the AO, the more destruction you see and the more holes in the buildings and the less people you would see, because a lot of people don't like to live there.
Yes, understandably, yeah.
But then you get to your deployed area, you get your weapon, and then when I arrived there, I was 10 minutes there and was handed my rifle, ammunition, web gear, body arm and helmet, and I was told, you're going to Tyre Barracks. And I went, oh yeah, wherever that is, let's go. And it was a month of mayhem.
Yeah.
You know, absolute mayhem. And I couldn't wait to get back to my platoon, where I was kind of comfortable with all the guys because we knew each other from training. And then it just was active. It was what I expected. Well, it was more than what I expected, but...
Mm. And that first tour, there were Israeli troops on the ground there. They were still controlling half the country.
Yeah, well, they're in the process of withdrawal. And an army in withdrawal, it's like a dog with a wound.
Yeah.
You know, they're less than friendly. You know, they do things like reconnaissance by fire. When you withdraw, they withdraw through a village, give a village a name, Srebin. They approach with the tanks and they fire at the village and at the outskirts, and then go through it. That's putting everybody into the bunkers and into their homes so they can go through it without incident. And then when they get through it, they have to recce the road. Because tanks are expensive vehicles. They don't want to go cross-country in them. They like them on the road. And roads are usually mined. Like, the easy way is always mined.
Yeah.
So they do that. I mean, they'll use up all the tanks, ammunition and everything else because it's cheaper than a life.
Yeah.
You know, so...
So after your first tour, when you came home again, like, did home seem weird to you?
As I was saying earlier on, you have this heightened state of being. When you come home, the army says, okay, there's 28 days off. Off you go. Don't kill anybody. Don't hurt anybody. But you don't come from that state of being to normal. I mean, I would go for a beer with my dad. We'd go on the towers in Ballymun, long missing and lamented.
Mm-hmm.
My dad would always sit in the middle of the back wall where he could interact with his pals. He wasn't much of a drinker like I'm not. But I couldn't sit there. I couldn't sit there comfortably. I had to go to the corner because all I was responsible for was that 90 degrees.
Yeah.
Because I could see everybody coming in and coming out. And I noticed it. It was pointed out to me. And then I noticed that I'd go to a restaurant, sit at the corner table, or sit at a table at the wall, never sit in the middle, never sit at the window. Get on the bus, go to the back, you know. It was just all those wee things that just happened, and then you'd have loud noises. Your reaction to loud noises would be embarrassing, because sometimes you'd hit the floor, sometimes you'd jump up, other times you just have a spasm.
Yeah.
People were looking at you like, you okay? But you weren't okay. You know, you'd get the shakes and I'll be back in a minute and go out and get some air.
Yeah.
You know, the transition was tough, but you're 28 days to get back into the stream of things. So when you're back to your unit, you start to train again for whatever. The army always trains. It doesn't let its people.
Mm.
It doesn't count as lazy people. So that took your mind off it. Over the years, I noticed it had a cumulative effect. Like, the more you went, the more you took back. And I always had the reason I went so many times is because I had this I didn't have a mission accomplished feeling.
Mm.
And you went to give, you went to serve and help. And when you came back, I didn't have that I have achieved feeling. After my last tour, I was there for a year and I knew I had done the right thing. I knew it.
Yeah.
That was enough for me.
Yeah. And had you, over the years of your different tours, had you noticed things improving or did they remain the same? Largely?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. My first tour was 84. My last tour was, I don't know, 2000.
Mm.
And I could see the improvements, incremental improvements. I'd be there for 6 months, back for a year, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I could see the improvements. I could see the roads improving. I could see the buildings improving. I could see people coming back from the north where they'd been forced to evacuate, much like they have now.
Yeah.
But I've never seen it as painful as now.
Yeah.
But that's a whole other conversation.
Well, you've seen the difference between 84 and 2000, and now that's and the relatively good state it was in 2000. That's all gone now again.
Yeah, yeah. And it would bring a tear to an eye, you know.
But, yeah. And did you notice, you noticed the effect it had on you after the first tour, and you said that cumulative effect. Did you notice it getting worse and worse?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I mean, I suffer with PTSD. I have a lot of problems with, like, here now I'm starting to shake. Sorry about that, but
sorry.
There you go. But I noticed it getting worse. I noticed not lack of sleep, but like nightmares, flashbacks, and interacting with people that I didn't know was uncomfortable. I would tend to, nice, how to meet you.
Yeah.
And move away and let somebody else have the conversation, just listen in. Interaction wasn't a good thing. It was bad for relationships, you know, because they'd ask you what's wrong and you can't talk to them about it.
Mm.
You know, that tap is always closed. You know, that information stream that you have in there, it's always closed. You don't release it because it's absolutely terrifying.
To let it out.
Yeah, yeah. You have it under control most of the time and then sometimes you don't. And you're not nice to be around.
And when you would reach that point, could you find any relief?
Yeah, it comes to certain people, different people in different ways. For me, it was, I had suicidal ideations, I had breakdowns, you know, I walked away from my whole life.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to get it back. ONE contacted me and asked what I was doing, how I was, and I was just on the ragged edge. Effectively was about to drive off a harbour
because
I just couldn't deal with what was in my head. And over the course of about an hour, he said, come to us. We know what to do. And I trusted them because I knew the people.
Yeah.
And effectively, ONE, without putting it any other way, they saved me because I was one step away from not being here anymore.
And so what did they do for you in kind of practical terms? What does that mean?
Well, they have a good support service, they have a good counselling service, and that really, really helped me. Plus, they put a roof over my head, you know, because my relationship had broken down, essentially because I was just broken.
Yeah.
They put a roof over my head.
When you went into counselling, was it hard? Did it take a while, I suppose, to talk about, you know, to turn the tap on that you were?
No, I've been going to counselling for quite a while. And the big thing that would resonate with me is familiarity with terms. Like when soldiers speak about military things, we use a lot of acronyms, you know, APC, you know, IED, you know. Civilians don't understand those things. So you're speaking a new language to them and you have to break them in. And that's you doing all the work.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. So when you're speaking to a military person, like a qualified counsellor who's been a military person, that removes that initial barrier you have to break down, because you can go straight into it and you can let them know what's bothering you. And I found that invaluable.
Yeah.
And that service is provided by ONE. The government doesn't provide it. ONE provides it.
And is that voluntary?
It absolutely is, yeah. Yeah. I mean, ONE have counsellors. They're, I can't think of the name, veteran support officers, VSOs. And it's open to any veteran. Like the Defence Forces has good psychological services now, but they had zero back when I was there. But I think it's only this, about now they've started to invest in veterans' services, but it is minimal. Like the ONA runs an appeal every year called the Fuchsia Appeal. And that's how they account for the majority of their income. I mean, a certain amount of it's funded by the government, I'm not sure, but the balance is made up entirely of voluntary contributions and fundraising.
Yeah.
And without that, I mean, there are 20-odd people in the house in Smithfield and more around the country who benefit from this. And without ONE, all those veterans would be probably dead.
So there are a lot of people, if you like, from your generation of soldiering who, you know, kind of, the army said, thanks very much, that's grand, lads. And, you know, they walked off into the sunset and they were scarred.
Well, yeah. Well, see, soldiers have a really black, dark sense of humour.
Yes.
And I couldn't do it here because your listeners would be all crying.
Yes, I know.
You know, but it helps.
Mm.
You know, I can explain it best this way. I went into a get-together of veterans recently. And I walked in and the abuse was monumental. And it was brilliant.
Yeah.
But everybody around was going, it's going to be a fight here. It's going to be a fight here. And you walk over and you grab your mate. Oh, I haven't seen you in such a long time. And it's brilliant. And it's